you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Mole Talks. I am Michael Rubino, your host, and today I have an amazing guest. His name is Eric. Eric, first off, thank you for taking the time to be here. I know you are working on some really amazing things every single day, so really appreciate and value the time you're taking here to share your story. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and let people know why you're here?
Okay. My name is Eric Johnson. And as you say, I've wound up in a pretty unique position in mold history and in chronic fatigue syndrome history. So I have some insights into how the progression of this paradigm came about and might be able to clear up some of the confusion about it.
That's amazing. Yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, definitely want to kind of talk more about that timeline because it's extremely unique, right? When did you first become impacted by mold? And maybe, you know, maybe at that point you weren't totally aware that it was mold, but just to bring this full circle, when was it that you first became ill from mold exposure dealing with chronic fatigue?
Yeah, I don't know if you can see this very well.
You can actually, yeah.
But that's where my mold experience starts.
That's amazing. This you got is, the visual there too.
Yeah, this is the old Strawberry Hotel, an old stagecoach stop on the Sonora Pass Bridgeport Toll Road. So it's a very old building. My family took over managing this hotel in 1964. And I immediately realized that I was in trouble. I mean, I was getting headaches, rashes, nosebleeds, incredible fatigue, cognitive problems. It was all over the map. So I was sensitive to mold pretty much right away. And my parents took me to multiple doctors and they absolutely did not have a clue about mold back in 1964.
Yeah.
And the way I connected
mold. Some still don't have it now, right?
what really hammered it into me was that various parts of the hotel affected me more than others. But we were expanding the kitchen to put in a larger dining room and restaurant area. And we burrowed through the back wall to install a walk-in refrigerator. And when we opened up the wall, all these newspapers spilled out, covered with black mold. I mean, this was such an old hotel, probably before insulation, the pink insulation was developed. We found out they had insulated this hotel with wadded up newspapers. And they were covered with black mold. And we thought, well, these are probably historic newspapers. You know, maybe they're valuable. Maybe we can try to read them. And I held on to one of these newspapers trying to read it through the mold. And I just instantly collapsed. The effects were so profound. I mean, instant nosebleed, wild headache. I couldn't even stand up. I literally crawled to my bed and could not move for days. So that made it clear straight off that something about this black mold was knocking me flat. And I couldn't really recover from this exposure. No matter how much I tried to stay outside, get exercise, lead an athletic, healthy life, just the time that I spent inside knocked me out far more than any allergy. It really had permanent, it affected my development as a child, really slowed me down. I mean, it put me behind in school. My headaches and fatigue were so bad, I could barely function, couldn't really socialize with other kids in a normal way, except during the summer. During the summertime, in order to free up room in the hotel, my brother and I would go out and sleep in the buggy barn, a little coach, you know, shelter next to the hotel. And every summer, I would recover to the point of acting and looking like a normal kid. And I wanted to sleep out there all winter long, but my mom wouldn't allow that. But this drew my attention to mold so dramatically that it was on my radar all through the development of this paradigm, the emergence of this mold epidemic, because I was watching how people's attitudes toward it existed in the 1960s and 70s. I could see this growing awareness. Now, I still suffered from sensitivity even after moving out of this hotel, no matter where I went. And I wound up at Lake Tahoe in a high school that also had this same type of effect on me. Not the entire school, just the front entrance. I would try to avoid at all, do anything to try to, you know, not go near the front entrance, but unfortunately, that's where the dean's office and that's where the bus lets you off. But I would actually run around to the east entrance of the school, try to use the side entrance, and just momentary exposure to this one area knocked me out in the exact same way that this old hotel did. And it was the same thing every winter. I would get worse and worse. Every summer, as I could spend more time outside, I would recover. Even though in school, this seemed to be my only exposure. My house was fine. In fact, I'm sitting in that very same house where I grew up right now. It's my parents' house, and it has no effect on me. So I was aware that these exposures from somewhere other than my house could have such a driving force that it wouldn't do any good to test my own house or focus on that specifically when these exposures from elsewhere could completely overwhelm what was going on in terms of my health. This school that I went to wound up becoming extremely famous later on because that was the site of the original chronic fatigue syndrome outbreak, which doctors could not figure out. But I got out of high school, and in my quest to try to recover my health and have a good, healthy, athletic, adventurous life, I joined the Army. And I wanted to go someplace interesting. So I signed up for a really interesting MOS, nuclear missiles, wound up getting shipped overseas to Germany to a bunker that was built to be Hitler's forward command center for the invasion of Great Britain. A really amazing place, concrete structure, you know, the classic secret underground bunker with many different layers and levels and iron doors, all completely fortified concrete, no sheetrock, no chemicals that we knew of. It was just all concrete. And the basement armory flooded. And black mold started growing all over the cardboard boxes in the basement of this armory. And I fell apart in exactly the same way that I had grown accustomed to at the hotel and at the school. Realized it was affecting me, had many conversations with my commanding officer about it. My entire unit got sick, everybody. There were hundreds of people. A strange flu came through, and it affected my unit more than any other in this complex. Hundreds of us wound up on sick call, just unable to recover from a flu. At this time, we were having terrorist attacks from the local Bader-Meinhof Red Army faction terrorist gang doing harassment of American troops in Northern Germany. This was in the mid-1970s. And because the effects in my unit were so severe, my commanding officer actually called the Biological Warfare Division to come out and investigate to see what the heck was going on with so many sick people on the basis that maybe this terrorist gang might have acquired some poison, something to weaken us, make everybody sick. And the unit came out went over everything as much as they could, couldn't really locate any problem, and they didn't seem to attach much importance to the black mold down in the basement. But they did agree that it would be a good idea to clean it up. And guess who gets detailed to go down and do it? I realized that I was going to be highly affected by this black mold due to my past. And I asked my commanding officer if I could use my M17A1 gas mask as protection. And he thought that was a terrific idea. In fact, he wanted all of us who were detailed to go down to clean up the mold to wear our gas masks. But he applied to battalion headquarters and they said, no, those are reserved for warfare. You don't need them to clean up a mere allergy. So I get sent down into the bowels of the armory and I'm carrying out cardboard boxes dripping with this black mold. And within an hour, my platoon leader looks over and says, you better get out of here, Johnson, or you're gonna pass out. I crawled up to my bunk, collapsed, and there again, unable to move for days. And this knocked me down to an even lower level of health where I was extremely hyper. I mean, I was hypersensitive before, but this put me through the roof. I got so bad that even in winter, I would crawl out to the motor pool, crawl under a camouflage net and hide in the motor pool, trying to get some sleep just to get a break from the mold in that building. And even though it was cleaned up, the effects lingered for a long time and my unit stayed sick for the next year. My commanding officer told me that if the rate of illness didn't decrease after this so-called remediation, that he was going to order an emergency evacuation of the garrison. Just take us out to the field, get us out of there on his own authority. It was that bad. But over time, the rate of illness did decrease. People got back to work. There were fewer and fewer people going out on sick call. And I wasn't the only one affected. There were quite a few that were left ill, permanently ill from this exposure. But I was more affected due to my previous experience with the black mold. And I finally told my commanding officer that I couldn't re-enlist. I had to get out. I couldn't tolerate any more of this.
Yeah.
So I get out of the Army, get home, back to Lake Tahoe, and have a really good summer. I'm windsurfing. I'm hiking. I get a mountain bike. I'm doing terrific. And then my stuff from being in this unit arrived. It was shipped on a slow boat and it took several months for my goods to get back to me. I unpacked it and instantly was overwhelmed by the same effect that I felt in that building. And it plunged me into total relapse just for my possessions. So here I was getting an education on how contamination of my possessions, that alone could be a driving force. And this led me to make more efforts to get contaminated objects away from me, to spend more time in good buildings, less time in bad buildings. But there's a lot of moldy buildings out there. And this is a really difficult paradigm, a difficult reactivity to try to avoid completely. And I wound up running into more and more bad buildings down in the Bay Area in the early 1980s, being knocked flat by these buildings and seeing how other people in these buildings, they were showing the same effects that I was. I described this in Dr. Richie Shoemaker's books, Mold Warriors and Surviving Mold, where I saw more and more people being beat up in these buildings the same way I was. And we could not get doctors to listen to us. So I got to a point where I was once again completely under the power curve, unable to function, essentially. And since I was having so much difficulty caring for myself, I went home to Lake Tahoe to my family once again. And just in time for a mystery illness to hit Lake Tahoe. The first doctor that I went to see with my mold illness, actually slightly before this outbreak began, was Dr. Paul Chaney. This was because I was directly across the street from his office. And by chance, I became Dr. Paul Chaney's very first mystery illness patient. And this flu progressed through the Lake Tahoe area, made hundreds of people sick. He called the Center for Disease Control for help. So they came out and concluded that this was kind of a savage flu. But other than that, they really couldn't make out what was going on. And thanks to having all this mold experience, I told Dr. Chaney and the officials that were doing this research, you know, it's very strange that of the people with this mystery illness who failed to recover, it was the clusters in the sick buildings that stood out. Most people, if they got this flu, if they took care of themselves, you know, ate right, tried to get sunshine and just basically live a good, healthy lifestyle, they would recover slowly. But the people that were not recovering all had the commonality of being exposed to the same buildings, which possessed the same sensation that affected me as my previous in the hotel and in this moldy bunker. And sure enough, what stood out was my high school, that front area. That cluster was the specific one that Dr. Gary Holmes came to investigate, and he could not figure out why all these teachers in this one teacher's lounge failed to recover. And I go, wow, that's surely got to be the toxic mold. And this is my opportunity to make a real dent in this paradigm and get help for all of us who are suffering from this. Because Dr. Chaney asked me to volunteer as a prototype for this new syndrome. And I told him, well, I'm kind of worried about your focus on trying to find the mystery virus, because there's this complicating factor of the mold. And he said, don't worry about it. These researchers are good, they're competent. They will come back and they will figure all this out, so your mold clues will not interfere. And I go, terrific. As a prototype for this new syndrome, researchers will come and talk to me. I can show them how the clusters of failure to recover were in the sick buildings, and specifically in the closest proximity to this black mold, and we can clear up this whole matter. That's where I ran into something I didn't expect, which was nobody ever did come back to investigate. The moment the chronic fatigue syndrome definition was written, the matter was dropped. And from that point on, researchers identified people using this very vague, nonspecific definition that didn't have any real markers or clues to go by, called that chronic fatigue syndrome, and no longer took any interest in the actual incident that this syndrome was based on. And that led to my efforts to contact Dr. Shoemaker and many, many others and try to put this mold factor back into the syndrome. So over the next couple of years, even though the Center for Disease Control and all chronic fatigue syndrome researchers never looked back at the clusters, of course, the school did, and the people owning the buildings did, and they took advantage of the emerging paradigm of toxic mold, which in the early 1990s, about the 1994 to 1998 period, had become so well known that it finally occurred to them to look for toxic mold in these buildings. And sure enough, they found not just, you know, mold in general, but Stachybotrys chartarum. This was found often enough that it was a common denominator. It stood out as a very special mold, something that with immunological effects that far exceeded your standard normal run-of-the-mill molds. Well, the researchers, in the course of looking at some of these early clusters, had written up an abstract, the Chester Levine paper, which is kind of on my poster right here, which was the only attempt ever made to try to pursue the clusters in the sick buildings. It was concurrent sick building syndrome and chronic fatigue syndrome, epidemic neuromyasthenia revisited, Chester and Levine, 1994, which described not only the Truckee High School cluster, but several others they had found, specifically a school down in Elk Grove, California, and said the development of the chronic malady in the sick building syndrome setting calls for further research into whatever might be in these buildings, which makes perfect sense to me, because if you take a look, you may probably find the toxic mold. And to check this, I called up the teachers in Elk Grove who were identified with, diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, and said, we had a similar incident at the original chronic fatigue syndrome outbreak. And did you run into this toxic black mold Stachybotrys? And they said, yes, that's the one. So clearing this up was actually as easy as making a phone call. Now, in terms of what I had to do with my lingering sensitivity, is the chronic fatigue syndrome doctors didn't have much to offer. They were plying us with supplements, with various antiviral remedies, which sometimes worked temporarily, but people tended to relapse, especially if they went back into a moldy building. So I proposed to chronic fatigue syndrome doctors, what if, rather than try to recover using an antiviral drug or supplements, what if we focus on a strategy of extreme mold avoidance instead? What might be gained by that? And even if we can't expect total cure, can we avoid relapsing? The seasonal downturn, the winter blahs, which they always blame on seasonal affective disorder, can we avoid that? And their awareness of mold was so low that they said, no, mold is just an allergy. That's probably not going to work. And since their therapies weren't doing much, I told them, well, I have absolutely nothing to lose by trying. So I went ahead and did it and enjoyed such a spectacular recovery that you would never think that I ever had chronic fatigue syndrome or have any problems at all. As long as I maintain the scrupulous level of extreme avoidance of these particular bad places, I look and appear completely normal.
So first off, I wanted to say, like, I am just totally enthralled by you and your story and, you know, your passion for not only figuring this out for yourself, but you've actually helped pave the way for people like myself to exist in the first place. So thank you for all that you have done. You know, for all of us that are going to continue to carry the torch forward, you know, including what you guys are doing over at Exposing Mold. So I wanted to take a moment. I couldn't even do myself any justice by even talking or interrupting you because it was just a really powerful story. We talked about chronic fatigue syndrome, you know, and some of the headaches and stuff like that. But I just want to wrap the symptoms part up, because I'd love to dive more into, you know, mold avoidance. I think that's going to be really helpful for people. What were your symptoms like besides what you've already covered? And maybe explain a little bit about the fatigue, because I know some people have this misconception as far as what chronic fatigue syndrome really is, what it feels like. And I would just love to kind of transition from there into, you know, how you started to recover and this whole mold avoidance that you've come up with that's worked spectacular for you.
Well, the chronic fatigue syndrome is a really fascinating entity because this flu-like illness that hit Lake Tahoe was so scary, was so devastating, had such strong neurological features that people were terrified of coming to Lake Tahoe. It was crushing the economy, absolutely massacring the ski tourism. People were canceling. You know, people come to Lake Tahoe to ski from all over the world, and they were calling up and canceling, saying, we don't want to come to Tahoe and catch the mystery illness. This mystery illness had made national headlines, and the whole world was terrified. And it's often said that the illness, whatever this Epstein-Barr virus illness was, it hit the country, but Tahoe got all the publicity. And that's true because Dr. Cheney and Dr. Peterson, they really focused in and publicized this whole thing. They brought out the Center for Disease Control, scared the world to death. And those of us who got this transient flu-like illness that went through, we had a disabling neurocognitive phenomenon that was equal to severe dementia. As Dr. Cheney put it, people who got sick with this flu couldn't find their own way home. People would get lost in a town with one stoplight. You couldn't remember a phone number. Nobody could. If you tried to, the math teacher couldn't add. The English teacher couldn't conjugate a sentence. People could not function. So aside from the devastating drop dead fatigue, which was literally something that would strike you so severely that people were bedridden, could not stand up. If you wanted to get to the bathroom, you had to crawl on your hands and knees. It was a really terrifying illness. And in the midst of all this, they wrote up this definition and originally planned to give it the name myalgic encephalomyelitis, or at least post-viral fatigue syndrome, realized that this was so scary that this would not alleviate the fear of coming to Lake Tahoe. So the Holmes Committee, the Center for Disease Control, hit upon the most amazing plan. Give the syndrome a really stupid, trivializing name, which made it sound like chronic fatigue. And I thought, oh, that's not going to work. People, they read the newspapers. They hear about the neurological problems, the disabling autonomic dysfunction, the postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, you know, all these abnormalities that are so far beyond fatigue that the very name itself, chronic fatigue syndrome, is probably going to cause doctors to wonder, what the heck is going on here? How could such a terrifying, horrible disease have such a trivializing, idiotic name? Much to my amazement, doctors simply accepted it. It's like they fell for the trick. And all they had to do is come back to Lake Tahoe or read in the many books, newspaper articles, documentaries that were made about it, that this was actually a very savage, disabling neurological illness. And it seems to me that the combination of the virus plus the specific neurotoxic mold, and we know Stachybotrys chartarum in particular is a powerful neurotoxic agent, that this was too much for our immune system to handle, and we wound up sensitized, primed for future exposures. Because everybody I know came out of this left with a lingering sensitivity to sick buildings. So I came up with the idea of doing what I call the chronic fatigue syndrome mold history tour. And I would take people from all over who had been diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome to these very buildings just to observe their response. And it affected them all in exactly the same way. They could all sense it. They could tell. And this wound up in various books, documentaries. And even this did not result in any researchers coming back to straighten out what chronic fatigue syndrome really is. But it very much appears that what the original chronic fatigue syndrome was an overwhelming combination of a powerful flu-like illness plus this neurological agent of toxic mold. And it may not always be Stachybotrys, but that one stood out so often, it cropped up so many times that I felt that if I focus on this one, draw the attention of researchers to the most outstanding example of this process, that'll pave the way for comparison and find out what other agents this can be extended to.
And I have to say, I think you've done an amazing job at that, right? I don't think there's a person on this planet who doesn't look at the word toxic black mold, you know, that traces back to Stachybotrys shatarum. So, I mean, the fact that people know about that is such a remarkable thing. And I think it does help pave the way. And I have some actually interesting questions about that, just because, you know, I'm not going to call myself a researcher, but I have some interesting data sets just going into people's homes for so long and looking at all these pre-tests, these post-tests. Do you think that, and let's say Stachybotrys is the biggest problem that we have in when looking at mold exposure, what are your thoughts on, you know, Stachybotrys being the mold that creates the sensitization, but then when you're around other molds such as Aspergillus or Ctomium, that once you're sensitized, I mean, any mold can trigger you. Do you have any thoughts in regards to that?
Absolutely. It's a very well-known phenomenon in multiple chemical sensitivity circles that once you're sensitized to a primary agent and that inflammation goes on and on and on and your body never gets a break, you start spreading. There's a secondary reaction to other chemicals and more and more and more, and your list just keeps getting longer and longer and longer. And in chemical sensitivity, the people who have had great experience with this found out that no matter how hard you try to avoid your secondary reactivities, this doesn't really seem to make a dent in it. But if you can identify your primary, avoid that, pay less attention to your secondaries, just do everything you can to avoid your primary irritant, that the secondaries will abate. I applied this principle to Stachybotrys, and I thought, is there any way that I can learn to isolate Stachybotrys, hone in my senses so that I can tell that this is really what I'm exposed to and not these secondary things? And for this purpose, I had John Banta, the prominent mold tester, identify a sample of Stachybotrys chartarum for me. I took a sample about the size of a postage stamp out to the desert, got as clear as I possibly could, waited until I was feeling good, everything's great, and then did proximity experiments just to this one sample of a known substance so that I could train myself to recognize it. This helped nail it down to me that Stachybotrys alone was capable of being a driving force in my symptoms because I tested it by taking it to the desert and going near it. People thought this was an absolutely crazy thing to do, but I'm glad I did, because paying attention to this one sensation and treating it as if it were plutonium had got me greater recovery than anything that I can see being accomplished by mold doctors.
Thank you for that. I think that was, a great question of mine, right? In terms of I've been in people's homes that didn't have Stachybotrys, that had other molds that seemed to be causing them a reaction based upon what they're experiencing. And I had wondered, you know, is it a possibility that when we're children or younger in life, we're exposed to molds like Stachybotrys that are toxigenic. And then through that, we get triggered later in life when we're around other molds, maybe that aren't Stachybotrys, that can cause some sort of sensitivity. So it's interesting to hear, you know, your view on that.
Well, this proximity experimentation that I did with such a tiny sample suggests to me that there's a strong possibility that when people are reacting to lesser molds, the kind that don't normally bother people, that maybe there's an extremely low level exposure from Stachybotrys that has not been found.
It's always a possibility,
Yeah, I think there's a good chance that Stachybotrys is so off the charts in terms of a toxic mold that it's a way paver for reactivities to molds that otherwise never bother people.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at carpenters who are cutting up lumber covered with mold all day long, and it doesn't seem they can go through an entire career of inhaling all kinds of mold. Even people, remediators, who formerly would just clean up flood damage just dressed in their normal Levi's and get a crowbar and knock out the sheetrock, whip it all out. I mean, they were sucking down so much mold, and yet we didn't really have a strong history of remediators dropping like flies. But that seems to have changed in the last 20 years. And now people, these volunteers cleaning up flood damage in Hurricane Katrina, or remediators that spend a lot of time going from building to building to building, are becoming sensitized. And very often when this happens, it eventually turns out that Stachybotrys was involved.
Yeah, no, that that does make sense. And even as a remediator, if it may, it's always possible that Stachybotrys, a heavier, stickier mold, isn't showing up in the air sample. It's not on the swab, but when you open the wall to remediate, you could be remediating Stachybotrys without knowing it, because you're not stopping the job and retesting. You're just removing any and all mold inside the area. So it's a very strong possibility. And based upon a lot of the conversations that I've had with you, it's been in the back of my mind. So thank you for giving me that perspective. We're running short on time. And I think one of the biggest things I want to ask you about now as we pivot is talking about mold avoidance. You said through mold avoidance, you were able to heal. And a lot of people that come here, they're looking for answers on how to heal, and would love to hear your journey through that and how you've came through the other side of that.
Well, after doing these proximity experiments, going out to the desert, I started to describe it to people. And somehow my strategy of turning myself into a mold dog, learning how to identify my primary irritant, translated into, Eric says we all have to go live in the desert, which is not a lot of fun, and certainly wasn't my goal. I really had a plan, and that was to get clear and train myself and hone in on my primary irritant. And this turned out to be a terrific way to get better, because by my refining my acute awareness of this one particular thing, and I know it sounds crazy because we all want to look at this as some kind of toxic soup where we have to avoid air fresheners and pesticides and diesel fumes, and that's kind of impractical. And I took a gamble on this spreading phenomenon and really, really paid attention to that sensation of the one thing that I learned to fear in Stachybotrys-ridden buildings. And whenever I encounter that, I would get out of there as quickly as possible and decontaminate, take a shower, wash my hair really well, change my clothes, put my clothing outside so I wouldn't be bringing contamination home with me. And as a result of that, I was able to actually move right back into the very same location where I got sick so many years ago. And even though I travel around, go to these same buildings, and some of them are still sick buildings, I can handle it now. I can't spend a lot of time there. But if I get out and follow these procedures, decontaminate, lower my inhalation, my rate of inhalation in these places, I'll literally do that. I'll try to slow down my breathing. I will try to step away from the worst portion of the building. And over time, my tolerance has grown that I am existing in the very same area that I know is fully capable of driving me back into relapse. But with a little careful attention to this sensation, I can handle it now.
Amazing. And so you really just have figured out, you know, how to slow your breathing down and how to decontaminate. And it's allowed you to avoid mold much more frequently than you probably normally would, because we take 20,000 breaths per day. And I don't know what that would be like if you slowed your breathing down, how to quantify that. But even if it's half the amount of breaths, I mean, it's significant, right? It's very interesting. And are there other things that you've done to avoid mold? I mean, you said something about you being in the house that you got sick. Did you fix the issue that was creating the water damage and the Stachybotrys?
Well, the houses that I've been in where I've been sick and I've had to evacuate a few, some of them could be remediated and some could not. And I decided that, several houses where I have lived, I finally determined the problem wasn't really in my house, it was my neighbor's house. And every time the wind blew from a certain direction, and I would go out and check the wind direction, I would relapse. And I realized that no amount of remediation in my house was going to fix my neighbor's house.
Yeah.
So I would actually say that one of the primary tools in mold avoidance is whenever you feel hit, whenever you feel the telltale sensations that you might be exposed to mold, stop and check the wind direction, even if you're inside. Because a draft coming through a house might give you an indication of what portion of the house is wafting this stuff toward you, and you can go to the other side of the house. And that is, it's such an automatic rule of mine that if I'm driving down the road and I feel hit, or if I go into an apartment complex or a certain part of a building, I stop immediately, check the wind direction, look upwind, and see if there's any telltale signs of something upwind of me that could be emitting a plume of these toxic spores.
I'm ingenious, right? To go out and look at wind direction and stuff like that and try to pinpoint where it's all coming from. I mean, these are things that most people wouldn't even think of. Inspectors aren't looking for. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because our houses are not hermetically sealed, you know, and the wind definitely affects and impacts the air quality.
Yeah. And don't testers and remediators use smoke sticks to,
you know, in the past, yeah, I mean, we've used them in the past. I don't think we would use them all the time, but for the negative pressure and stuff like that. Yeah. But I would say, I don't think the testers really do use smoke sticks much. I haven't really heard of them in the past 10 years being used to try to locate different where things could be coming from. I think they are doing more of a visual inspection, looking for signs of water damage and kind of going that route. So it's very unique, right? Especially if you're trying to deal with complex problems that you can't fix, or like rehabs that have been rehabbed over where there's no signs of water damage. You may have to really start to look at what's the air patterns here.
Wow, I got so much value out of looking for micro plumes that I would carry matches with me and I would strike a match and blow it out just so I could observe which way the smoke was blowing.
That's amazing. Yeah, like I said, I don't think many people, right? And that's one of the things that makes you so remarkable is your ability to kind of pause, take a step back and look at all of the different things that are going on inside the environment. I don't think a lot of people would do that. And you know, why don't we talk about, because I think that's so fascinating. Why don't we talk about if you were to do that, right? What would that tell you?
Throw in a plug for the U.S. Army. This isn't really my strategy. I didn't really dream it up. This is standard biological warfare training, because they tell you how to look for plumes, check the wind direction, look for exposures from upwind. That is absolutely major. I mean, anytime you are on a biological warfare or standard ordnance battlefield, you want to look for wafting fumes, things that are moving on the air towards your location. So I was trained in all this, drilled in it to respond automatically. And when I realized that mold was affecting me much the same way as a biological warfare agent, my training kicked in. And so I have to really give credit where it was due. And it was my training.
Well, yes, biological warfare training definitely gives you an unfair advantage for sure. But that's fascinating. That's really cool that you can, that they taught you kind of how to look for these plumes so that you can see if, you know, the enemy is putting anything through the air that could impact you, and how you can utilize that training to apply it to the situation where you're looking with biological contaminants inside your own home.
Yeah, so that's really what it looks like. It's a constant lifestyle of assessing for potential toxic irritants that are around me. The idea of testing in the sense that I could go in and test a house and make a determination if the house is okay for me doesn't really apply at my level of hypersensitivity. So I'm looking for spot plumes. I'm looking for contaminated objects, for a corner of a house that could be emitting a very small plume. And one way to imagine this is to think of a smoking ashtray, like a cigarette butt, just putting out a little wafting plume. Because very often you can feel mold hits and visualize exactly as if it were the smoke from a cigarette. Step to one side. All you have to do is just step a few feet to one side of that plume, and it will drift past you just as smoke in a smoky bar might do. And you can keep some of it off your clothing, out of your lungs, out of your hair. And just exactly as you would not enjoy inhaling somebody else's cigarette smoke, you can avoid mold plumes.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I've never really heard that concept until you spoke today. So I think that is really amazing for people who are looking to avoid mold. It's good to know that you can put yourself in different areas of the home to really observe how you change in your feeling. Do you recommend keeping a journal?
I guess for some people that's useful. Once we have a fairly clear idea of the mechanism of this, I don't think it's really necessary. And unfortunately, the people who have kept journals, they didn't really connect their wavering sensations, their fluctuations in their illness to any particular phenomenon. So that didn't really seem to be a productive tool.
Now, like I've talked to certain people who they don't have as good as a radar, right? Where they may not feel the impact until hours later, as an example, where it seems like you really were so tied in, you had more of an immediate reaction. I've definitely talked to clients that have that as well, but what about the people that don't have that instantaneous reaction? It could make it a little harder for them to avoid mold in that, I guess, that regard, right?
Well, when I started out this journey, even though I could get a vague sense of exposure, if it was an overwhelming or really bad one immediately, I would have that delayed response. Mm. In fact, I started timing it. When I realized that certain areas were affecting me, I would deliberately go there, start my watch, and watch my progression of symptoms over the next couple hours to try to find out when my peak of reactivity was. And that was about 4 hours. So yeah, it was a confounding factor, because the bulk, the most intense reaction I would have might occur hours later. And the only way I knew this was by repetitive trips through the same location and realizing there was an aftermath later. However, once I got out to the desert and got clear, this seemed to put my body into a detox mode that unveiled my sensitivity, as if the body was trying to reprogram itself for a greater sensitivity to my acute primary irritant, and my reaction time became quicker. The more time I spent out in the desert, out in the wilderness, the quicker the reaction time became. That lag time gradually faded away. So I wondered if this applied to others. So as I taught them about this technique, had them to go to the desert, I found the same thing. More time in the desert, the more time unmasked, the quicker the reaction time got, the better their ability to detect these exposures.
Wow. I mean, that is honestly fascinating. So you really figured this out to a science. You had all these different experiments that actually allowed you to evolve and adapt this principle. I guess, how practical is it today to go out into the desert and experience this? Are we at a point in 2022 now? I can't believe it's 2022 already, where is it more practical to avoid mold in other ways in the path that you took at this point in time? Or would you still recommend people are doing what you're talking about?
Well, this is highly impractical. It is very difficult, time consuming. You have to put a lot of thought into it. You have to know what you're looking for. It's a pain in the butt. And I did not intend to become any kind of mold avoidance guru or teach people how to do this for the purposes of making this into some kind of viable lifestyle or any kind of therapy. Really, my major goal was to study this to the best of my ability and then put this information into the hands of our top researchers so they could develop the concept and they could make the determination what they want to do with this.
And I have a feeling that the second part of what you just said did not come to fruition the way you had hoped.
yeah, obviously.
All right. So to keep this more light, because I think that if we start going down that path, this will probably get a lot more technical than the average person would like to hear. What are some of your closing words here in terms of, you know, what from your journey can people learn from that can really help them, you know, understand what they should be doing as next steps? A lot of people that listen to this, you know, their families are going through, you know, some tough times. And, you know, sometimes you have a husband and wife where the wife is not feeling well, the husband doesn't understand. There's families that are impacted and, you know, some people have issues with their families even thinking this is real. So, you know, would love for you to you know, give any last closing advice that you can give. This has been such an amazing conversation, and I don't think we'll ever have as much information as we did in this podcast episode.
Well, I'd just like to say that mold avoidance is a journey. It's not something that you can go out and undertake or succeed in immediately. It starts with the concept that there is a toxic mold and that you can avoid it. There are small steps that you can take to put yourself on the path to taking control of this. And every little bit helps. So that once you simply become aware that this is possible, that it's real, and that you can step away and you can take these little steps, you're automatically develop ways of considering how you might do that. Getting out of a bad building, avoiding a certain object, getting you know, something out of your life that you brought in that kind of made you feel not quite so right. Just all these little things add up. And there are a lot of people who are on the verge of illness, who are just starting into hypersensitivity, where by taking these little steps, simply becoming aware, they kind of almost automatically guide themselves into subtle forms of avoidance and experience some kind of recovery.
Yeah, that's amazing. And where can people find you, Eric? You know, I know you want to talk about exposing mold a little bit and you know, your journey that you're on today and how people can find you and help support you.
Well, Alicia Swami and Keely Severson have aligned with my goals of trying to get this information into the hands of top researchers. We formed this podcast, this group called Exposing Mold. And our goal is to talk about this as much as we can, bring awareness, eventually, hopefully get this into the hands of researchers, and with a little bit of cooperation, put some of these strategies that we've developed into practical application. So we can be found just by looking up the Exposing Mold podcast.
That's amazing. You know, and I really appreciate all you do, all you've done, all you continue to do. Same with Alicia and Keely. You guys are amazing. Your podcast is absolutely unmatched. Thank you for all you're doing, and really appreciate it. For everybody listening, like I said, I don't know that we'll get a much more informative technical podcast as we have today. I hope you've learned as much as I did just by having Eric Johnson here with us. Eric, thank you so much.
All right, glad to be of service.